Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the AfridaLoveShow.com. And actually, the format of this particular show is going to change because this is actually a project that I am going to present to other peers. So on today, we will have the opportunity to meet Ms. Rita Williams-Garcia. Ms. Rita Williams-Garcia is the author of many literature books that have been studied in many universities, as well as you may see some of her books in many school libraries and at book festivals. But Ms. Rita Williams-Garcia is an American writer of young novels. She won the 2011 Newbery Honor Award. She won the Coretta Scott King Award and the Scott O'Dell Award for historic fiction for her book. And some of her famous books are One Crazy Summer, Gone Crazy in Alabama. She won the Penn Norma Klein Award, and her book PSB 11 won the Coretta Scott King Award in 2014. In 2016, her book Gone Crazy in Alabama won the Coretta Scott King Award again. And so we're going to hear the different perspectives of multicultural education with Ms. Rita Williams-Garcia, and I'm going to put her on the line. Thank you for holding.
Hello.
Hello. May I speak to Ms. Rita Williams-Garcia?
Speaking.
How you doing, Ms. Williams?
Hi. How are you?
Great, great. I'm so excited that you allowed me to interview you about your literary works.
Oh, sure.
And you know we're being recorded because this is
yes.
for a project.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, first of all?
Well, I came to write very early in life through my love of stories, just being able to tell myself a story, and from looking at picture books and imagining the story. So storytelling has always been kind of in me. And then I had a very vivid imagination. So if my mother asked me something simple, I could never give her a simple answer. I always had to add something to it. I'm the youngest of three. We're 12 and 13 months apart. And for the most part, we lived the life of being Army brats, Army children, and we were all born in Jamaica, Queens, New York, but we traveled across the country and grew up pretty much in Seaside, California, and then we went to Georgia, and then we returned to New York by the time I was 12, which was when I started sending stories out to publishers, to magazines and what have you, hoping to sell my first story.
Wow, that is exciting, exciting. And I can tell that, you know, just from reading your books and just from listening to you articulate everything that God has blessed you with, you are a dynamic writer and speaker as well.
I thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am. Now, what do you want people to think of when discussing multicultural literature for children and young adults?
Well, first and foremost, I want them to always fully engage in the story and those characters, and so that you're stepping out of yourself and into those characters, and that you see the humanity in those characters, and you understand their wants and you know their strong points and where they need to grow. But in terms of a lot of the stories that I tell, I always want to kind of say, you don't quite know everything. Here's just a little bit of what you're missing in the overall picture. Now, don't you find that a little interesting? You know, and I think we need to find each other interesting, our diverse cultures, just the different ways that we are raised. You know, I mean, I come out of an Army culture, you know, so that's very different from when I came back to New York to live in a more or less kind of you know, working class neighborhood. It, very different, very different. So I think those differences transcend across the board, and that we can all kind of share into each other's experiences, understand what loss is for many of us and what a triumph is for us and what struggle is, and we can do that safely in story.
That's great. That's great. Okay. Now, when you introduce literature, as far as your writing is concerned, what kind of genre would you like to exhibit to your readers?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask that, because when I was writing One Crazy Summer, it didn't occur to me, not really, that I was writing a historical novel in the sense of being truly historical and having perspective and that distance with the past. But for my readers, yeah, that's 50 years ago. That is, it don't get more historical than that for a lot of them, because you just don't have all the technology and social advancements, of today. So they're really looking at the past. So in one sense, you know, I really do like being able to do that, to kind of take a look back at history as a way of saying to ourselves, oh, wow, look at where we came from. But also, some things haven't changed much, and we need to still have these conversations. So, when I first began, it was very important for me to write stories that I thought young people of color, particularly African American, but also out of the African and Caribbean diaspora, I wanted to write stories that I felt were everyday common stories, but no one was writing them. So when I first got out of school, now that was 1980, I had this story called Blue Tights, Big Butt, and it was about a girl who wanted to dance ballet, modern dance, but she did not look like what a typical dancer looked like. And so I wanted to talk about positive self-image, but I also wanted to talk about a culture of men and boys, but mostly, you know, I would say men, preying upon young girls.
Okay.
And so I wanted to talk about these things that I knew was everyday life, that girls were dealing with, but no one was writing that story. But on the flip side, I also wrote a story. My next novel was about a young man who graduated at the top of his high school and accepted into Princeton, but he would have to go through kind of a summer orientation, which he resented. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of learns that he's not all of what who he thought he was. And so it really is a story about confronting oneself, confronting one's, areas of struggle, and admitting that that you got to dig down, that you're more than what you're more than your press, you have to dig down and be that person and work for it and all of that stuff. Because it's very hard for people to deal with ego, especially if you stand on a pretty tall plateau, in your community, in your family, or so forth and so on. So ego, those kinds of things. I thought that was very important to have that conversation, especially with young men. So back then, I was really trying to deal more with things that were going on. But I was like, okay, how many stories about guns, basketball, and gangs,
Right.
Come on now. There's so much more going on.
Right.
No shade on anybody else, but I'm just saying that there were just so many different stories out there, and we needed a lot more people to come into the field and start telling those stories.
Oh, wow, that's a great explanation. And like you said, we really need to tackle those issues that are obscure, because a lot of books aren't written to individuals who prey on young children or individuals who are different, from what society would expect them to be when participating in, for instance, gymnastics or something like that.
Yes.
It's very important.
Yes.
That's good. That's good. Okay. Now, I'm going to tell you, I love your two books, One Crazy Summer and Gone Crazy in Alabama.
Aww.
What inspired
you? Did you read PSB 11?
Ma'am?
Did you read PSB 11? That's the book in between the two.
Not yet, but I need to.
Okay. All right.
And we can talk about that book as well. What inspired you to write the series, and what message do you really want to get out to readers? Because you have a very strong message in all of your series, and I just want you to articulate it so that everyone can hear it.
Okay. So when I started with One Crazy Summer, I did not think of it as being a part of a series, but as a standalone mission. And because I grew up during the late 1960s, I was very much aware of all of the political and social upheaval and revolution that was going on, and I admired but was also kind of leery of the Black Panther Party.
Right.
So I remember that children were involved. I, my sister, brother, and I had even had we've had breakfasts courtesy of the Black Panther Party, you know. And so I wanted to talk about that. I wanted to talk about this place in our history where young people weren't having it, and they weren't just, yeah, I mean, they were so articulate in terms of their platform and their aims, but yet they were ready to throw down too, you know. So I wanted to talk about that, but I wanted to talk about it from a child's point of view and not necessarily from a much older person's point of view, because I felt that that was one way to welcome the reader in, the young reader, to know that, yes, on one hand you had Dr. Martin Luther King and SNCC and the nonviolent movement, but you also had this militant movement that came after the assassination of Malcolm X, and was heightened because of it really began as a self-defense in our neighborhoods, you know, just like you have Black Lives Matter, you had the Black Panthers who were saying, no, you know, you cannot just walk up to citizens and crack them over the head with a billy club because you feel like it. So I wanted to talk about all of those different things and talk about those things to young people in ways that would not turn them away from being a part of it or knowing a little something about it. I wanted them to engage in this part of history and that part of change. And so in the middle of writing this story, you know, I have to know my character so well and understand what motivates them. And often what motivates a character is something that happens in their past and who they are made from and where they come from. And whenever I start to talk about a character, I know things about their childhood, their early childhood. I know things about the circumstances of their birth. Then I start to understand about their people and, you know, and the story of the people, and then it goes back and back and back. And I'm like in the middle of One Crazy Summer, and I'm saying to myself, oh, my goodness, this is not just this one story. You know, I have to now, there is a book two. And then in the middle of book two, rather before book two began, I went, oh, book two is going to end on this somber note. And there is still yet one more journey that has to be made, and we can't have them go west then back east without them coming from where Big Ma was from, which is the South. And so that's where we get a good deal of the family story. So it was really wanting to tell one story so badly, but then understanding the character so much that I knew that there was more story to tell. And thank God I was able to get through it. Yay!
Yes, they're excellent books. Now, let me ask, I have to ask you this question. So the three young ladies portrayed in your story, are those individuals that you personalized their characters and made up, or you know some individuals and you put it, you structured it together so well?
Okay, so... While I was writing the stories, I made these characters up. They are completely made up. But it helped a lot that I had the dynamics of being in a household of three children. So I knew how alliances worked. My sister and brother would get together and form an alliance against me, stuff, because I was mommy's favorite, mommy's little baby, according to them, and stuff like that. So I knew about those kind of dynamics. My sister was the oldest, and so she really had had the responsibility of us. But who she was, my sister was very artistic, and so her personality is nothing like Delphine's personality. But here's what I've come to discover. As I go out and talk to students, and I think I must put on a little bit of a show, because everybody thinks that I am Vanetta. I am like, oh, really? But then again, see, I am the youngest, and I know what it is to be like off to myself and inside my little world, like Fern. Right. I was extremely nerdy, so not as I would say, definitely not as cute as Fern. And then there is the part of me that records things. Now, I have my diaries from 1967 through 72.
Wow.
In that aspect, that I paid attention to the world and what was going on, what was going on in our household, in my own little crushes and stuff, elementary school crushes, and what was going on in the world. I had a father that went to Vietnam. I had a mother who worked on the anti-poverty program. I watched the news. So that part of me that was aware of what was going on, that's the kind of Delphine, I didn't realize how much I was maybe relying on certain aspects of myself or what I knew to write the three different persons. And I'm glad I didn't know it at the time, because then I think I'd be too aware,
right.
And I wouldn't sculpt those. I would be heavy-handed about sculpting the character so that it wouldn't be so much like me in this aspect or me in that aspect or whatever. I'd be too aware of myself. So it wasn't really until I went out into the world that and kids asked questions that I thought, well, that's kind of like my sister in this kind of way, but not really. It's kind of like my best friend. But not really, and stuff like that.
Wow. I really admire how you structure your characters, because those personalities are real and people can actually connect with those personalities.
Yeah. That's the thing. At the core of characters with voices, especially characters who really get to appear 3D and have their own wants and foibles, you can drill a lot deeper. You can you can connect those things to things that you know, the things that you know are true, and it comes out through the characters. You know that, okay, so, and you would see this more in PSB 11. The relationship between Big Ma and Pa, that's a very real dynamic, that that mother who loves her son, but boy, she would do anything for her grandchildren, but she would also not spare the rod either, you know. And so those conflicts, it's love and conflict, that kind of the mother who will not approve of the mate that that her son chooses, no matter who it is.
Right.
You know, we know those things to be true. You know, we know those things do happen. But the best thing to do for me is to know that there's humanity behind that. No matter how misguided it might be, there's something deeply emotional and true to the core with the character, and this is why they react the way they do, you know. And I think the more that you understand and are willing to go with human nature, and the complexity of human nature, I think the more that I'm sharing with and helping people to understand each other, and to consider something outside of, well, that's not right. You know, of course it's not right. It's just, it's human, you know.
That's right. That's right. Wow, that's great. Okay. Now, what are some of the issues you see in the field of multicultural literature as far as when you visit schools and you look at the libraries, or even reviewing your own public library, or just the data which recognizes that it's not much African-American literature on the shelves or in the bookstores?
Okay, so the first book that I was telling you about, Blue Tights, Big Butt, it's now called Blue Tights. Well, actually, it's out of print. But that novel got written because I was working with a group of girls when I was in college who were below the literacy curve. And so I was looking for, they were high school students, and I was looking for a book that I thought maybe they could engage in, and I couldn't find it. I wanted to share Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, but I felt it was beyond what they could grasp or approach with their limited reading skills. I would have to read everything to them, and they would have to really stay with me, and that was a struggle. So all that to say, I remember going to the neighborhood library, which was in Hempstead, which was where my school was, and I was looking. I couldn't even find Friends by Rosa Gee. I mean, I couldn't find anything. So I started that night typing up on, okay, Blast from the Past, mimeograph, which is like the sheet, and then it has like this ink in the middle and another sheet and carbon or something. Anyway, I started typing up like a skit that they could reenact, and they could take turns being the characters. Anyway, so that's where coming out of, and that's what I felt I was fighting against. Not only that, but I was also fighting against a white or establishment publishing that said, what is this? What is she talking about? Shouldn't she be fighting racism? You know, those very personal issues that I wanted to deal with, that those real and personal issues, that was like, oh no, what is that? So I felt like I was fighting that. Now today, when I go to schools and libraries, oh, it is the most beautiful thing you want to see, because you see class sets of books by Jacqueline Woodson and Jason Reynolds and Kwame Alexander, and you see works by emerging authors of color and diversity, And so it's not that it's all fixed now, because it's not, because those numbers are very scary and very low. But the push is really on in schools to get those books in. And it helps so much to have the American Library Association recognize a diverse titles, you know, when they're awarding the Caldecott or the Newbery or the Prince or the CSK, hey, Puerto Belpré, you know, and all of these different categories, because then libraries can just scoop these books up and not have to do the search, because let's face it, resources and time. So it really helps a lot to have the ALA, but also to have groups that are emerging to curate lists and just to promote a range of diverse stories. It is happening. It is a beautiful thing to go and see to see all of these different books. It's just beautiful, but it's still a drop in the bucket, you know?
Right, exactly. You're right. Now, let me ask you this so that readers will know, where are your books located? I know some of them are in Barnes & Noble, of course, online. What about the percentage of school libraries in New York?
Okay, so, yeah, it really does help that the big chains will carry me. I'm going to tell you that was not always the case. It was because of one crazy summer that won all those medals,
right,
that they could not deny me. So I tell you, I struggled for years to have a presence in bookstores. But I do now have more of an online presence and in bookstores, but also in schools. That has helped tremendously, schools and libraries. Now, here's a trick. Here's the trick thing. I can only speak about the ones that I've been to.
Okay.
You know, because I go to a school and, look, they've got my book. Yay! I'm all thrilled and everything. Okay. But that doesn't mean in the next school they have my books, you know, or they have Tracy Baptiste books or Jewel Parker Rhodes books or Cynthia Leidick Smith's books or, you know, so forth. So, that online presence, Twitter, Facebook, you know, social media really helps a lot to bring communities together, literary communities together, it's so wonderful to see that people who used to say, "Oh, well, my students might not like those books," are piling those books in their baskets by the truckloads, you know, wherever they can. You know, these things are starting to change. And I think social media helps an awful lot, but also the school visits that that kids get to see a diversity of authors, you know, live and in color and in the flesh and in the voice. And so they can see our personalities and experience us and know that we were, you know, nerdy, goofy, you know, troubled, whatever kids, and that, you know, we're not someplace in a tower locked away and that only certain people, you know, have admittance. No, you know, you're going to run into me in the grocery store with my coupons, you know, and what
right.
have you, you know.
I know it. Yes, ma'am. Okay, great. All right. Now, do you think, I know we kind of touched on this before, but do you think that more books like, for instance, One Crazy Summer and Gone Crazy in Alabama, that really focus on family will be in classrooms and libraries and bookstores? I know we touched on that a little bit, but I'm coming from the perspective of, do you think that if enough voices articulate that we need multicultural education, will we begin to see those books filtered in those particular places?
Yes, I truly do. And again, I have to say the validation of the award from the American Library Association, that really plays a big part. It's not everything, but it is huge in terms of getting these books into schools, because you have some schools who have such small budgets, and so they can only order the medal winners for that year, you know. Oh. So when you have a book like Crown by Derek Barnes, when Caldecott and the Newbery Honor Awards and the CSK, I believe, also when those things happen, you know, you can see that these very familial stories, these everyday stories of everyday people. Kind of walking with pride or with struggle, you know, or families just experiencing what families experience. When Christopher Paul Curtis won the Newbery Gold for the Watsons Go to Birmingham, you know, when those things happen, those books cannot be denied. They are a part of the American story. They are a part of the world story, which is why translations are really key, you know. And so those books belong. They make their way into all of these libraries across the country, and they are doing their ambassadorship. They are working their magic on people who never thought to pick up that book, but then they do, and they go, "Oh yeah, this reminds me of when." And I'm getting a chance to see that more and more as I go out in the world. Now, you know, I don't like to fly,
yes,
so. Anytime y'all see me, you know, 300 miles away from Jamaica, Queens, New York, y'all know I'm giving you a gift, because I done shed a piece, a year, a month, and a day of my life to get on that plane. But, you know, when people tell me their stories, and it's a diversity of people telling their stories, you would be surprised. People with with maybe a racist past, or, you know, or a tortured past in some kind of way, they connect with something that's going on, or maybe they understand or see something for the first time, and it brings them to tears. So these books are not just for our children. They are for the children within us. So, you know, I think we are doing our thing, but the field must be made wide and open, because there are so many stories to be told, and it's not just for the select few of us to, you know, to be able to tell them.
Okay, that's good. All right. Now, what new projects do you have coming up?
Okay. All right. So, okay, so I have a YA project that I cannot talk about.
Okay.
And it's killing me.
Well, let me know when it comes out.
It is killing me, because I want to talk about it so badly. But it is a story that spans at least about 80 years.
Wow.
And I'm telling it from a different perspective, and so it presents a lot of challenge for me, which is kind of what I need, so that I don't get comfortable and, you know, and start believing all the things people be saying about me. I better work. But I do have a gaming novel that I wrote it back in 2008. Either 10 or 11, and I have to fix it. And I think one of the changes that I make, we'll see what I'm going to do to it.
Okay.
I have to see if I can swing it, you know, because I might not be able to. But I'm going to try.
Of course you can.
We shall see. Wish
okay.
me luck. Pray for me.
I will. And when your project is finished, let me know.
I certainly will.
Okay.
I will.
Now, let's before we get to the last question, I didn't address the medals and awards you've won. I know you're a very humble person, but I want to hear the different medals and awards you won. It's not bragging, because I'm asking you. I didn't want you to think that. You know what I mean? tell us about all the awards and any more books you want to discuss. We have some time.
Okay, so I have, let's see, I don't know them all, but I do know that I am a three-time Coretta Scott King Author Award winner.
Wow. Amazing.
Let me tell you what that means to me. There is nothing quite like home and people and for family to recognize you. You kind of do need world recognition so you can pay your rent and buy all the catfish and greens you want, you know. But when your own recognize that what you have written is valuable and that it is the truth and that it has a great place in our history, and is indeed a part of our story, there is nothing that quite beats that for me. I have to say that the Newbery Honor that I won for One Crazy Summer is the award that has allowed me to stay in my apartment and be able to write full time. I was on the brink of being evicted. My editor had told me, "Oh, make sure that I get the USA Today newspaper." And I said, "Okay, you know," but I knew I was on my way to housing court because I was just having a struggle, and I would probably have to pack up my things and put them in storage. And anyway, so. Judge happened to have that newspaper, and I said, I remember where it had to be, and I turned the page because the question was, how will you stay out of this trouble, you know, like of being late or not being able to pay your rent. How will you stay out of this trouble? And I remember I turned to that page and I said, "That is me." They had a picture of my book and also Sharon Draper's book. And I said, "That is me. I am being considered for an award." And I said, "Even if I don't get this award, so many people have read it that by April, which is royalty time, I would be more than caught up." And,
wow.
And, you know, and it was just kind of, so that was Wednesday. The following Monday was when I learned that One Crazy Summer had won the Newbery Honor and, of course, the Coretta Scott King.
Oh, great.
That it was just indeed powerful. You know, people like to say, "Oh, Rita, you get all these awards, la, 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 la," you know. But I think so oftentimes people confuse the quality of the work with the money.
That's right.
And it's not that I don't get paid, because I do, but you know, the business of writing, the writer's life has a business aspect to it, and you do have to get paid so that you can continue to write. And we're oftentimes months and months between paychecks, and, you know, people don't really realize that. So I'm going to put that out there. So that was a very important award for me, and it still is. The Scott Odell Award really helped to garner a legitimacy of this of that time period, that movement, as to having a place in American classrooms, not just high school, but elementary school.
Yay.
They're in the third grade reading about the Black Panthers, you know?
Wow.
Come on now.
Mm-hmm.
And then Let's see. The National Book Award. I love the going to. I think I love going to the National Book Award more than I, you know, care about getting the award. And in that case, that is the absolute truth, because that party is so good. You know, we're all so happy, and then they have a great band, or rather a DJ.
Ooh.
Afterwards. The food is good. The speeches. I, you know, that is like my nerd prom. I love it. But I have to say, the NAACP Image Award.
All right.
I just won it for Clayton Bird Goes Underground.
Really?
And yes, I did.
Congratulations.
And indeed. I mean, I remember finding out that I was nominated. That was good enough for me. To me, I had already won. All right, now, nomination, good enough. Because I saw the titles it was up against. Jason Reynolds, I'm blanking out, but Jason Reynolds, Kwame Alexander, Angie Thomas, you know, and all these people. I was like, y'all take some pictures and of the parties and everything, and just let me know all about it. You know, I wasn't getting on a plane to shed a year and a half and a day of my life, you know, to walk the red carpet and clap politely, you know. No. Although they do serve they do host an awesome after party. Okay, but anyway, so when Kwame posted it online at 1 o'clock in the morning, I don't remember. Well, I usually don't go to bed that early anyway. So when he posted it, I looked and I kept looking at it. I didn't believe it. And then Mr. Shoe, John Shoemaker, who is like the ambassador of children's literature, mm-hmm. he also tweeted it. And I was still like, what? No. What? You know, it took a little while, but the award, they had to send it to me. That thing is heavy. That thing is heavy enough that I can, you know, I can use it to work out with. You know, it is like, it is. Who needs a kettlebell? I've got my NAACP Image Award. So here is the one thing that is so wonderful about that. I had the privilege of going to libraries in underserved communities that I live in South Jamaica, which my mother lived in the projects. And went to this one particular library. So I brought my Image Award with me. And after I did my presentation, I let the kids come up and hold it, you know. And there is, you know, the pride that they feel. It's more the pride of, hey, look, I can carry this 2-ton award, you know. But it's that. Here is something, you know, you see all these stars on TV1 and BET, you know, for this award show. And you know you ain't going to, like, hold an Oscar in your hand. Well, the chances are not so great, you know, or the Emmy or whatever have you. But here it is. Here is an award, and you can hold it in your hand.
Right.
And it's to say it's all within reach. Everything within reach. And so, you know, I try to make sure that I go, make sure that I come as myself, and so people can really see me and go, she nice and everything. She's like my auntie or like my grandmother or something like that, you know, so that they know that what it is that you do, it's all in reach. It is not locked away in some distant land and only certain folks can do it. You can do it too. So
Well,
that's what those awards do, and they mean to me. And it really helps after, you know, when you go through maybe years of rejection, to have that validation and the respect of your peers. It means an awful lot.
Yes, ma'am, it does.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good, that's good. Seemed like I was at the award ceremony with you or something.
Yes, yes. You know, I don't quite understand. I know that people get very upset during award season because it, you know, because the awards are meaningful. They mean an awful lot. And so then they make themselves very unhappy and all of that if they don't win or they don't win the one that they felt they should have won. And oftentimes that is the case. That happens, you know. There are times that, you know, that books that should be gleaming and glistening with medals get nothing, you know. So I always say celebrate all of your wins, your triumphs, celebrate them, but make sure you celebrate those who win as well, you know.
That's right.
You know, be part of that community. Keep lifting yourselves up and, you know, enjoy each moment.
That's right. Now, is there anything else you would like to share that hasn't been shared?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Today is my daughter's due date, so I am waiting on my first grandchild.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes.
All right.
These are the important things of life.
That's right. Okay. So, anything else?
Oh, that would do it.
Well, I want to appreciate your time because I know your schedule's busy. You're getting ready to be a grandma, and I'm so excited for you. And I'm going to stay connected to you because I want to know what this new project is. And,
okay.
I want people to support your books, and I'm going to support them as well.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. So thank you so much, and it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Likewise.
All right,
have a blessed day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Miss Rita Williams Garcia, and she is one of the literary poets that different universities have been studying in class, and I've been reading her books for some time and had the opportunity to interview with her. So please be sure to connect with her. Her books are on Amazon, and I thank you so much for listening to the interview with Afrida Love. Thank you so much. Have a blessed day.